All right, good morning, everybody. Welcome back. I hope you had a great Memorial Day celebration. It should have been a celebration that was tempered by remembering those who have died. 1.3 million Americans who died defending our country so far, and the number is only going to get higher. This is Tony Beam. I'm Director of Church and Community Engagement for the Tim Brazier Campus of North Greenville University, where Christ makes the difference. My co-host is Austin Barker.
Morning, everybody.
I got to preach yesterday at Ebenezer Baptist Church. I appreciate Vince Ganey. He and his family were on vacation. They asked me to come in and pinch hit for him. And, you know, I'm reading a book called Live Not by Lies, and I want to recommend it. It's Rod Dreher.
Rod Dreher.
Dreher, yeah, yep. Dreher. Is that how you pronounce
Dreher.
It? Because I've called him Dreher, Dreher, Dreyer. I mean, I don't know.
I think it's Honeopath.
Okay. Oh, Honeopath. I got you. Well, anyway, it's an important book. If you haven't seen it, I would recommend it. It's not it's a quick read. It's not like some of the other books that I've been slogging my way through and have finally been able to complete. But this one is important because basically what the book does is look at dissidents from communist countries, and it talks to them. They're interviewed about their experiences, how they survived the torture, the imprisonment, how Christianity played a key role in the fall of communism. You know, I didn't know this for years until I read Chuck Colson's book, The Body. And then it caused me to go back and look at the events that led to the fall of the Iron Curtain and the end of communism. And there were a lot of dissidents who were not believers, but the people who were leading in most of these areas were Christians who led because of their deep abiding faith in God and the fact that they understood that totalitarianism was a mind-numbing, destroying philosophy that was keeping people under the thumb of just a few leaders and denying opportunity for everybody, and certainly denying people the opportunity to worship God in the way that they felt like that they should. So here's what came into my mind, and that's what I was going to do this morning, is kind of share some stuff that came into my reading that book, Live Not by Lies. Being in the minds of people who lived under totalitarianism, who now say that the United States is enduring soft totalitarianism as opposed to hard totalitarianism. Hard totalitarianism is when the government just comes and gets you, and your neighbors spy on you, and they turn you in, and you go to prison, and sometimes you're heard from again, sometimes not. You're tortured, you're held captive, sometimes you're released, sometimes you die in prison. That type of totalitarianism is not upon us here in the West, and it may never be because of our Constitution, because of our understanding of freedoms and rights. And and then again, it could be. I mean, we could degenerate into hard totalitarianism. But these dissidents, the message is that soft totalitarianism is enough to destroy the country, that you don't have to have open persecution to the point of rounding people up and putting them in jail. You just simply deny them opportunity to participate in the public discourse, and eventually the ideas that soft totalitarianism puts forth, they dominate and become... they take the center stage, and even without violence. I mean, you don't have to lock people up physically. If you lock them up emotionally, if you lock them out of the public arena and the public debate. So this is, as I thought about Memorial Day, and I thought about how many people died fighting fascism, imperialism, Nazism, all of the isms, and yes, communism. The people who gave their life, they thought enough of what America is and what America has been to say, I'm willing to die. And that led me to this, I don't know if you know, but America, what is it, AMC, yeah, Network, has these World War II things that are in color. They've colorized black and white film that's live footage shot of World War II. And I don't know if you realize, but how much footage there is. I mean, you can watch. I watched, fascism rise in Germany. The parades that were glorifying Hitler. I watched it happen in Italy with Benito Mussolini. I watched it happen in Spain and different countries as Germany began to get aggressive in first going into Czechoslovakia, taking the Rhineland, then going into the German part of Czechoslovakia, and then annexing the Slovakia part of Czechoslovakia, and then annexing Austria. All of these were up until the point that the Slovakian part of Czechoslovakia was taken. They were German-speaking people that Hitler was bringing, he said, back into the fold. But then came the invasion of Poland, and then the invasion of Russia, and then, of course, taking over France and attacking Great Britain. And it became obvious that Hitler's goal was world domination. And the number of people young people who died, I mean, just they did things that they knew had to be done to protect those of us that were back here in the United States, those not born. I mean, I'm sitting here today living and breathing and able to do a radio show because these people said, if it costs me my life, this must be done. I must have heard that over and over again coming out of the mouths of these people that were being interviewed that are World War II survivors. Now, I don't know when they filmed all this because there are so few World War II veterans left. I mean, and all of them are either in their 90s or 100 plus. And so we're losing them. I mean, that generation is going to have passed away within a few years. We lost the last Medal of Honor winner just recently. And so from the European theater, so we're losing the people who made the sacrifices that allow us to be here today. So my question is for us to ponder for a little bit, what are we willing to die for? Is there anything, because one of the points that Dreher makes in his book is that Americans have, even Christian Americans, have succumbed to a level of comfort and materialism that is something that they don't want to give up. I mean, they want to stand for Christ, but what is it going to cost them? Is it going to cost them their next iPhone? Is it going to cost them their job? Is it going to cost them a better car, a bigger house? What is it going to cost them? Those who were resisting communism were asking themselves, is this going to cost me my family? Is this going to cost me my life? And they were willing to lay down their lives and risk their families for the sake of freedom and for the sake of the gospel and pushing back against atheism.
We're reluctant to share our testimony because of the social stigma attached to it.
Yes, and we're also reluctant to stand up against the soft totalitarianism that is methodically infiltrating and taking over the different systems of the country.
If it was a clear black and white line, I feel like more Christians would stand, but it's just this gradual slow creep that we don't know when to draw the line in the sand and say, thus far and no farther. Like, for instance, Biden's $6 trillion budget right now is not contained. For the first time since 1976, does not contain the Hyde Amendment.
Right.
So this is going to be compulsory. They are going to compel me as a taxpayer. They are going to compel me to fund abortion.
Right.
And so do I withhold that money from them and say, won't participate? Sorry, that's too far.
Well, that's a good question. But that's probably not going to pass. But it's a good point that's in there, that's part of the push.
That's the sum and substance of your question is, when are you willing to draw the line and say, no more.
Well, and when do we draw it?
Mm-hmm.
Because we're asking senators and representatives to draw it for us. So if they fail, or if they refuse, or if, you know, what then?
What guilt accrues to us?
What's left?
Yep.
Our scripture for today comes from Ephesians chapter 2, verses 4 and 5. But God, who is rich in mercy because of his great love with which he loved us, even when we were dead in trespasses, made us alive together with Christ. By grace, you have been saved. That's good news. And we don't want to get away from the fact that this, our program, is about good news. Before we go back to what I was talking about in the first segment, I want to throw this in because it does kind of tie in a little bit. Vice President Kamala Harris put out a tweet at the beginning of Memorial Day weekend that just simply said, it was a picture of her smiling, looking to the side. It's a very attractive picture, chosen because of its the way that it draws attention to her, the lighting, the highlights in her hair. I mean, the whole thing. It's obviously a PR shot. And she tweeted it out, and the message that came with it was, enjoy the long weekend. And that was it. So she got, and this is actually good news to me, that she got so much pushback that there were so many people who came after her that she was forced to put out another tweet that actually mentioned the fact that Memorial Day is about those who have died defending our country. And it was a pretty good the tweet that she put out. Actually, it's something that I don't think that she wrote. I think somebody wrote it for her. In fact, if you look at it, I thought that it was in this story. Maybe they actually didn't publish the tweet that she put out. Ah, here we go. Throughout our history, our servicemen and women have risked everything to defend our freedoms and our country. As we prepare to honor them on Memorial Day, we remember their service and their sacrifice. Somebody wrote that for her and said, this will rescue you after your picture being put out there with enjoy the long weekend. And that's all she had to say.
Do you know what I was doing Monday morning at 11 o'clock?
No, I do not.
I was at a parade in Aiken, South Carolina, a Memorial Day parade.
Excellent.
I was standing 3 feet behind a Vietnam veteran, and he had his hat on, and it was so moving to me. We picked the exact right spot to stand because all the people that came by looked over at him. A lot of them would give him the salute, several of them came over to him and said, welcome home, and thank you for your service, and, you know, all this. It was just so good for my kids. I've got goosebumps to see that dynamic.
Well, right now that's...
It was so meaningful.
It's extremely important for your kids to see that. And it's extremely important for us to remember those things. So I'm encouraged when I hear these things that a lot of Americans are still firmly rooted and grounded in the sacrifices that were necessary, and they're remembering what our country is, and what the fact that we're willing to make those sacrifices are what's led us to a place of prosperity that gives us the opportunity today to be addicted to material things, which is a bad thing, but we wouldn't even have that opportunity had it not been for people. And again, over Memorial Day, what we remember are the people who died, paid the ultimate sacrifice, 1.3 million plus Americans.
What you're saying reminds me of the cycle of the children of Israel, though, where, you know, they had this, God blessed them, prospered them, and that led them into a period of spiritual apathy, and then the luxury of the ability to just, you know, bow down before an idol because everything was good.
Yeah.
And so that brought judgment, and that brought devastation, and that brought repentance, and that brought favor, and that brought blessing, and
luxury's always been a real challenge for God's people.
Do you know Randy Alcorn? I think I've mentioned this to you before. He said that give me one man who can handle prosperity, I'll give you 100 who can handle adversity.
Yeah. Well, prosperity is something. You look at Ezra, the book of Haggai, where Haggai chastised the people because Ezra had led them back to. Haggai prophesied between the first and second returns of the people to after the Babylonian captivity, back to Israel, and Haggai is like, "What are you dwelling in your paneled houses?" I mean, he said, "You people are living in the lap of luxury." And the temple of the Lord is in ruins. You haven't finished the work on the temple. And Haggai's prophecies and preaching was a catalyst for a second return that actually completed the building of the temple. So God's people have to be kickstarted. I mean, we get comfortable. We like living in where everything is known and we're not challenged the world we live in anymore.
Yeah, the pitfalls of prosperity, boy. I mean, Paul says, woe to those who would be rich. They fall into a snare and pierce themselves through with many sorrows.
Right.
Jesus said that it'd be harder for a rich man to go to heaven than a camel to go through the eye of a needle. You know, and the disciples are like, whoa, how is that possible? How could you even be saved if you're a rich man? And like, yeah, the only way that's possible is with God.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the wealthy have it hard.
Because they come under the... And here's the other part of it, though. James says we don't treat the wealthy better because they're wealthy.
Right.
And we don't treat them worse because they're wealthy.
Yeah.
And see, the trap for us is to look at the wealthy and to think, well, you know, if I had their wealth, I would be doing so-and-so.
Yes.
Or if I, well, you would probably be doing the same thing they are. I mean, you know, with what they're doing.
And to be fair... people who, at my family size, we live under the poverty line for my family size. We are not poor. That is just a joke. That's like a joke that has been foisted on the entire American population. By global standards, we are fabulously wealthy.
Well, by global standards, I think the last time, the United States lives better than 95% of the rest of the world. And that's for people that are in what you would say... about, you know, under the poverty line in some
That's
regard.
Relative poverty, not absolute poverty.
Right. So, you know, we have been blessed, but we can't allow the blessings that we have to stand in the way of us standing up for the truth. And that time is now.
So easy to do.
I mean, it's now. It's when you look at what's happening to the United States military and to our police departments, this kind of came home to me. Over the week, as I was mulling these things over the weekend, you know, this attack on the United States military, where we talked about the fact that due process has been thrown out the window in the military in order to give the woke Pentagon leaders the opportunity to remove people who are conservative and who are conservative leaders because of their ideology, because of their belief, they're not woke. They're getting pushed aside so that the military can become more woke. So that, you know, and that's happening with our military. It's happening with the CIA. If you look at the recruitment video that the Army put out, you know, we talked about this a little bit. We made you aware of it, that there was a video out there talking about, you know, recruiting someone who grew up with two mothers and that this is the new Army. And then it was juxtaposed next to a Russian recruiting drive, which showed the virility of the people who are coming into the Russian Army. And, I mean, the message could not be more stark, is that as our institutions become woke, they also are transformed from conservative to progressive. And think about that. Our police forces around the country have, for people that go into law enforcement, are majority people with conservative principles. Why?
Law and order. Because
exactly.
We believe in the importance of law.
Being willing to lay your life down for someone else. The honor of putting on the uniform, of serving something greater than yourself. Those are conservative principles. Those are not progressive ideas. So, when you hear that the Biden administration is investigating all these police departments around the country and finding out how diverse they are, just look at it this way. The defund police is not to do away with the police, is the end game. The end game is to do away with the police by calling them systemically racist under the current structure, so that the police force can be replaced with people who are progressive and are much more willing to follow a progressive mindset as we go forward in our culture. And the same thing with the military. Because think about it. The military and the... If soft totalitarianism is going to take over a country, you've got to infiltrate the military and the police, because they're the ones that, if they don't go along, they have the training and the ability to push back. Just like when you talk to
local... power resides there.
Right. Our local sheriffs, for example. I mean, both Greenville County, Spartanburg County sheriffs have said, you know, we're not going to allow these policies to change the way we do law enforcement or to apologize for doing our job or for... And see, people like that have got to be pushed out if soft totalitarianism is going to become the order of the day.
So can I ask you a question, Tony?
Yeah.
In this world where, you know, you and I have grown up engaging with the political process and expecting that that's where Christians should do their fighting, you know,
sure.
or at least that we belong there, and that is a legitimate outlet for our spiritual inclinations. What is Rod Dreher and the people that he interviewed in that book, what solutions do they have for people like us?
Well, what they're saying to us is prepare for the soft totalitarianism. And what they're saying is create legitimate Christian communities.
Yes.
And to together proclaim the truth when you have the opportunity. Be bold in the stands that you take. Don't be afraid to stand and speak up. Be willing to take the derision of those who are going to come after you, because under soft totalitarianism, you're going to pay a price. It's not the price that these dissidents paid with years of torture and isolation in prison, probably, but you may lose your job. But you've got to be willing to do that.
And if I remember, now, I haven't read that book. That's on my list of books to read, but I read his book, The Benedict Option.
The Benedict Option.
And then right now, of course, he co-authored The Rise and Triumph of why can I never say this right? Expressive Individualism.
Right.
So I know Rod Dreher, and I read his stuff, and he's really, in my mind, a modern-day prophet. And one of the words that he'll use is insular Christian communities. He's saying to insulate yourself from the inevitable consequences that are coming your way as a result of soft totalitarianism. So he's saying to ally yourself with other Christians and build integrated networks,
right,
of which where you can employ other Christians. When they get fired from their job, they can bring their skill set in here, and we've already got an insulated Christian community where we can fix each other's pipes, where we can fix each other's cars, where we can do each other's accounting.
Right.
You know, we've already got those people in here, so we've got to. And again, you know, that's just people being Christians, serving, loving the God by going to work.
Right. And using their abilities.
And doing it in a way that benefits. And what did Paul say? You know, he says, show hospitality, particularly to those who are of the household of faith. That's what Rod Dreher is saying. He says, let's circle the wagons a little here.
Well, and when I don't think what he means, and if he does, I disagree with him on this point, and I don't think he means to withdraw or to not speak, but that the consequences of speaking could lead to the necessity of these Christian communities so that people can be cared for as they suffer the consequences of soft totalitarianism.
And it draws a more distinct line between Christianity and the world. And it's like, look what Christian worlds look like, look what secular worlds look like. And then one more thing that he would say is concentrate your firing power. That's my metaphor, not his. But he's like, instead of, you know, it's the divide and conquer mentality.
Right.
If they can scatter, and I think that prosperity's done that to the Christian church as well. I think that denominations are a luxury good. And so you have all this scattering and splintering of the church where, you know, I'll stand by you, doctrinal differences be what they are. I'll stand by you when it comes to hard times.
Yeah.
Well, anybody who names the name of Christ, you are my friend.
Yes.
You know?
See, and that's true. That's happening for... You know, as I've gotten more involved politically, I find that
common
I look
cause.
For allies.
That's it.
In Colombia, and some of them, I mean, there's a close relationship between me and several Catholics that are leading. We believe the same things
That's
about
it.
What's happening and what needs to happen.
Yes.
And so we're allies. And I think that yes, you're right. You have to find the people that are taking the stands and stand with them.
And that's why we'll make common cause with feminism when it comes to the T and the LGBT. You know, that seems weird, but at some point, feminists have a vested interest in keeping women as women.
Well, that's another point that Live Not By Lies makes, is that you do find common purpose, even with the dissidents who were not believers.
That's it.
They shared a common philosophy of what was happening and what needed to happen and what life was, the important things in life. And so they joined together. And through that, now and there's one section in that book that I disagree with. He's, for whatever reason,
he's a pessimist.
he highlighted the fact that, you know, that a lot of these dissidents did not try to win people to Christ as much as they just simply worked with them. I don't see that as being a fulfillment of the gospel. I think once you, yes, you make alliances. Now, you don't break those alliances if a person doesn't believe, but you also don't neglect the responsibility you have as a believer to share the gospel with those who are coming alongside of you on with common purpose. And I think that needs to be toward the top, not pushed down somewhere. And we're talking a little bit about sort of progressive woke culture, what's happening with it, why police departments and the U.S. military are two institutions that are now under attack under the Biden administration. And I think, again, you know, corporations have basically capitulated. You know, when Kellogg starts coming out with rainbow cereal that has different woke slogans on it about transgenderism and a multiple personal pronouns, we can pretty much look at that and say, you know, corporate America is completely shifted from a conservative, which corporate America at one time would be considered conservative because they didn't want, it's not that they were crusading for conservative causes, but they didn't want to join the what's now the progressive woke crowd because of the backlash that they felt like that they would feel. Well, they no longer fear that. So corporations become the purveyors of woke ideology by having these seminars that teach their employees that they should be ashamed because if they're white, because of their white privilege, and so on and so forth.
I want to say that that's not all of that you're painting with too broad of a brush with saying corporate America. But listen, go on there and read the list of sponsors of the corporate sponsors of the Equality Act.
Yeah,
you can't shop anymore. You can't do business.
There's 400 of them.
I used to do regularly. I did principal consumerism. You know, I wouldn't buy Citgo gas because it was Hugo Chavez and it was Venezuela and they were a communist country. And I'd do all these different. You know, I boycotted Home Depot and the American Family Association.
Right.
You can't go down that road anymore. That train's left the building.
I
think I just mixed my metaphors. I think that train has left the station.
Well, that's okay. that train has run through the building. I mean, it's taken down any possibility. Yeah, if you're going to boycott, I tell people this all the time. Well, I'm boycotting so-and-so. And I'm like, okay, are you boycotting this? And yes. Well, no. I said, well, then you can't be consistent in your principles.
And listen,
I mean, you can pick something, I guess.
Some are worse than others. You know, I mean, some are, you're saying, Kellogg's is out front. Home Depot for a while was sending, you know, their people into pride parades. And, like, I mean, they were sponsoring those events.
And I don't know that they're not doing that now.
That's it. I mean, but they're just not flying the flag quite as high, maybe.
Right.
And I don't know why AFA called off the boycott. They said that they accomplished what they felt like they set out to accomplish, and they withdrew their boycott. But I'm just saying that, you know, I mean, you look at you boycott Ben and Jerry's because there's a difference between being a social justice warrior and just kind of bowing the knee to
I mean, they're just out front about it. Mm-hmm. Now people would say that that's hypocritical because I don't boycott Apple, and Apple is a leader in all of the woke culture.
Google.
And that's true.
Yeah. Do you use DuckDuckGo? Is that right?
I use DuckDuckGo.
So, I mean, again, you just do what you can and don't pile guilt on yourself because of what you can't, because you're living in this world. But Rod Dreher says, you don't have to go out there and pick every fight. Don't feel like you have to go out there and say, you know, and the example that he gave, and I don't know if our listeners are familiar enough with the kind of the controlling image of that book, is that under this regime, the slogan was "Workers of the World Unite," and so you have a bread shop owner who feels the pressure to acquiesce to the social respectability program and put the sign in his window, "Workers of the World Unite," and that sign says something about your political allegiances.
Right.
And so this is tracing back to Alexander Solzhenitsyn, and Alexander Solzhenitsyn would just say, don't put the sign in your window. Don't tell a lie. You don't have to go out there and put a sign, you know, workers of the world, don't unite. You don't have to say that.
Right.
But don't tell the lie. Don't subscribe to the lie.
Because they're going to force you. But that's in soft totalitarianism. The first thing they're going to do is come and make you subscribe to the lie. If you don't subscribe to the lie, then you're going to be ostracized. You know, I was watching this last night. I was watching the World War, one of the World War II early days of Nazism, as they were going into, as they began to invade Russia, which Stalin believed Hitler. I mean, Stalin's getting all this military intelligence that Hitler's a liar and that he's going to come after the Russians eventually. And he just kept saying, no, I believe the guy. He's made a pact with us, a non-aggression pact. Well, then Germany, all full on largest invasion at the time of another country, invades Russia across a 1,000-mile front. Well, the people initially welcomed the Nazis. They felt like the Nazis were liberating them from Stalin. Stalin was starving people. I mean, the people out in the cities, that the when the Nazis would get there, they were handing flowers to them as they went by. They were considering the Nazis to be liberators. And then they found out that the Nazis were just as bad as Stalin. You know, I mean, under their regime, then the Nazis began to exterminate the Jews that they would find in these cities, and they would exterminate people who were pledged to the Communist Party. And they would, you know, because they were Hitler's idea was to get all of that out and create a new Europe. So,
listen, in that world, what is a Christian to do? And that's why I go back to Dietrich Bonhoeffer. He says, never has a group of people been subjected to so many unwinnable compromises.
Right.
It's just like this is, and I go back to Joseph Conrad in The Heart of Darkness, you know, and the main character is going up into the, and the moral judgment against that character for what he saw and basically tacitly approved of in terms of the racism and the colonial influence there, the moral judgment is just withering against him. But he puts his hands up in the air and he says, what was I supposed to do? Right. It was either, you know, it was eat dead hippo or get eaten by a bunch of cannibals. You know, it's like, I have no options here. And so that's how Dietrich Bonhoeffer felt. He's like, either, you know, I do the Hitler salute just to kind of fly under the radar so I can actually share the gospel later, so I have the opportunity, so I have the space. He's like, I do, because he got a lot of criticism when he was up in Sweden, and there was a whole group of them, and, you know, he did the Hitler salute, and everybody turns and looks at him like, what?
Right.
And, but you know, again,
he was executed for being part of the plot to assassinate Hitler.
As
so.
Christians, right now, under a developing regime of soft totalitarianism, we have got to look at each other and take a very soft hand. Because we're all learning how to do these things.
Yeah. As far as judging, you know, each other. I get that.
Is me wearing a mask, is that me telling a lie?
Right. See,
am I participating in the delusion?
That's a good point. Because there are those who would say yes, that once you put on a mask,
I wonder about it in my own. When I first walked into Walmart and had that mask on, I said, I don't believe that this mask works. I don't believe that there's. Right. I don't even know why I'm wearing this. Am I protecting you or am I protecting me?
Well,
I don't know why I'm wearing this.
I know why I was wearing it, because the people who own the store said that if you come and shop here, wear a mask. Now, it's Walmart store.
But why are they
store.
Saying that?
Well, I get it.
They're saying that because they're being told something that's a lie.
For a while, I was willing to say, I'm going to play by those rules.
Right.
Because I wasn't 100% sure about any of that.
Yes.
So I was, you know, I didn't wear a mask when I didn't have to, but when I was asked to, I put it on. And yeah, I was judged about that by some people would say, you know, well, you're just acquiescing to the lie. Well, I wasn't 100% sure that it was a lie.
Right.
Now I'm 100% sure that it is. And the people who said that it was nothing were right. I mean, they were more right than I was. In terms
more
of that.
Right. Do you see that? That gradation. And so if we don't have gradation and if we're not able to look at fellow believers and say, yeah, I don't know. I don't think that's right. but then give them the grace to be wrong, because we're all learning. I mean, this transgenderism thing has come at us so fast that some Christians are saying, you know, don't use the pronouns because that has a clear basis in grammatical meaning.
Right.
But go ahead and use the name that they're choosing. You know, if Jesse wants to be Jessica, that's just a name. There's not necessarily, there's a lot of wiggle room in terms of the genderedness of names.
Yeah,
I don't personally feel that way.
Right.
If someone that I know is a male and has been a male, comes to me and wants me to call them by what is culturally understood to be a female name, I'm not going to call them Stephanie.
Right.
I'm sorry.
And that's my conviction. I'm not going to, I kind of look at it this way. This is a fantasy. You're asking me to enter into it in a way that defies clear teaching of the Scripture.
And if it was just my daughter coming to me and saying, I'm an alligator, and I'm like, okay, honey, you can be an alligator.
Well,
that's a fantasy, too, that I'm willing to participate
in. But
this other one's destructive.
Yeah, and I didn't have that biblical foundation about the mask thing.
Huh.
I mean, I couldn't go back and say, you know, if I'm putting a mask on, I'm defying Scripture. But now I believe that I am undermining God's word and his teaching about gender if I acknowledge people who have a fantasy about their gender.
Yeah.
One of the things that, as we're talking about this soft totalitarianism and how it's affecting everything, one of the ways to look at that is in the story about Tim Tebow. I'm fascinated that everybody is having a fit over the fact that Tim Tebow has got a chance to play for the Jacksonville Jaguars. Now, keep in mind that Tebow, you know, Urban Meyer was Tim Tebow's coach at Florida. There's obviously a relationship there between Urban Meyer and Tim Tebow. I think they genuinely, you know, have affection for each other in the right way, a mutual respect. And so, and Tebow's one of like six, I think, tight ends that are competing to make the list. And he could get cut. I mean, he may get cut from the team, but he has a chance. He's out there working. He's trying to make it. And there are a lot of people that are excited about that because Tebow mania, one of the things they describe, you know, he's now one of the only players in history who has had a best-selling jersey in five different uniforms. I mean, you know, he's been a Met, he's been a Denver Bronco, and everywhere he goes, that his jersey sells out. So there are a lot of people that are supportive of Tebow. But then you get people like Devin Bush, who is a Pittsburgh Steelers linebacker, and he can't believe that Tebow has an opportunity to make an NFL team and Colin Kaepernick does not. I mean, he put two faces, laughing emojis. Tebow got a job before Kaepernick. Wait till we play Jacksonville. I mean, that's a threat. And then you have Stephen A. Smith, who said that Tebow's signing was a product of white privilege. Quote, when we see someone of a different ilk, of a different ethnicity, getting opportunities we know we would never get, Stephen A. Smith? Do you know what Stephen A. Smith's net worth is? I looked it up. $16 million. What is he talking about? Who is the we? Has he got a mouse in his pocket that's living on poverty? I mean, here's a guy who's an African-American sportscaster who has done extremely well. I mean, he's got an amazing career at ESPN. He's highly respected in the industry, and he makes a lot of money to do what he does. He's had incredible opportunities, and yet he would say that because here's an African-American who would say that systemic racism keeps African-Americans down. Here's a successful African-American by every measure saying that Tim Tebow doesn't deserve a shot at making an NFL team because of his white privilege. That's incredible to me. That's reverse discrimination. That's, you know, Stephen A. Smith would go out and say African-Americans don't have the same opportunities. And then he would deny an opportunity to Tebow because he's white. And by the way, this whole business about Colin Kaepernick had ample opportunity. In fact, they set up a workout, a tryout with NFL teams that were willing to come and watch him throw the ball and see if somebody wanted to bring him in as a possibility for as a tryout. And he walked away. I mean, the time came for all that to take place. He changed the workout venue at the last minute, said it wasn't acceptable. I mean, here's a guy that makes more money being a victim than he would ever make throwing a football.
Yeah, I don't think that he really wants the video cameras on him on the field. He wants the video cameras on him off the field.
Exactly.
He just wants attention.
The deal that he's made with Nike, the deals that he's made. I mean, Colin Kaepernick's net worth is more than Tim Tebow's. Tim Tebow's net worth is $5 million. Now, he's not a pauper. I mean, endorsements, what he's been paid as an athlete, his net worth, he's up to $5 million in net worth. But Stephen A. Smith is sitting there with $16 million and an incredible salary with ESPN, and he's coming after Tebow. Why? Because white privilege got him a tryout, and Colin Kaepernick is over here with no opportunity. It's a lie. It's an outright lie.
You want to go another step down this rabbit hole?
Okay.
Take a listen to this. Three short paragraphs. This is an article from Pro Football Talk, okay? Headlined, Devin Bush complains about Tim Tebow getting a job, then complains that the media noticed. So here goes. People in the NFL are reacting to Tim Tebow likely returning to the NFL. And this is where it gets funny. And people whose job it is to react to the reactions of people in the NFL are reacting to the reaction.
Yeah.
And the reaction is not good. So Steelers linebacker Devin Bush posted the tweet. You told about that. The folks at Bleacher Report, as they tend to do, since that's what they're there to do, noticed Bush's tweet and republished and publicized it. So Bush then responds with a tweet, retweeting the tweet with this message. Here comes the board media. Yeah, it's the media's fault. People say things, the media repeat it, and now that's the media's fault somehow.
No, it's not. Well,
I mean, he wanted to put the tweet out there,
right?
But he doesn't want the publicity and the negative, the pushback.
Well, of course not.
That comes from what he tweeted.
Exactly.
I never say this, snowflake. I never freaking say that.
And then you have Trey Burton, who he's a current free agent. He said, look, I don't understand the outrage. There are 90 roster spots. If they want to bring someone in, why not? A lot of teams take flyers on guys from various backgrounds every year. That's exactly right. But when it's Tim Tebow, he's a Christian. That's one thing. They can't stand that. And he's white. So it becomes white privilege, an attack against him.